This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Immigration could change drastically under the new Trump administration. Among the dozens of executive orders he signed on Monday are numerous actions around deportation, border security, and citizenship. Earlier today, the Justice Department sent a memo directing federal prosecutors to investigate state or local officials who obstruct immigration law enforcement. Today on the show, we are going to break down some of these immigration-related executive orders and discuss exactly how they could affect people in our region. And we want to know how you are feeling about President Trump's day one actions on immigration. Will they affect you or your community in any direct way? Give us a call at 800-639-2211. You can also send us an email with your thoughts or your questions to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. We're going to start today by looking at an order that effectively ends birthright citizenship for the children of some immigrants. But the Constitution guarantees citizenship to nearly everyone born in the United States. According to longstanding interpretation, that is. What's certain to follow is a long legal battle with roots in our region. The American Civil Liberties Union of New Hampshire, Maine, and Massachusetts have already filed a lawsuit against President Trump and other government agencies. Here to tell us more is Sang-Yob Kim. He's a senior staff attorney for ACLU New Hampshire. Sang-Yob, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me.
So you filed this lawsuit late Monday, the same day that President Trump was inaugurated and signed this executive order. Have you and your colleagues been preparing for something like this for a while now?
Correct. So even before the issuance of the extra order, we've been preparing for this lawsuit for a very long time. And we weren't sure whether we would actually see the order or not. And even after we see the order, whether the order's text would be different than what we had expected. But we have been preparing for this lawsuit for a very long time.
Was it different than what you expected?
No, it was not different. It was very broad as we expected. It was not only targeting so-called undocumented immigrants, but it also targeted broad categories of immigrants who do not have permanent residency.
So could you give us a little bit background on birthright citizenship? When does this right date back to?
So the 14th Amendment of the Constitution was adopted in 1868. And that's after the slavery and to make sure give all the citizenship right to the people who are born in the United States. And then after that, in 1898, through the Supreme Court case called United States versus Wong Kim Ark, the Supreme Court specifically held that every person born in the United States are citizens. Now, obviously, there is a limited exception, such as the children of diplomats, but that's not really the category that we are discussing in this lawsuit.
So tell us more about who we are discussing. Who could this affect exactly?
So in terms of the disorder scope, it applies pretty much everyone except those babies' parents are either lawful permanent resident or we call it green card holders or U.S. citizens. Good example is a couple studying and work, even temporarily working at University in Vermont, for example. Mm-hmm. The person's baby would not be U.S. recognized as U.S. citizen under this executive order because that parents are not lawful permanent residents.
And there are a couple local plaintiffs at the center of the lawsuit that ACLU of New Hampshire filed. Could you tell us about them?
Sure. So our main client is the New Hampshire Indonesian Community Support, which represents the Indonesian immigrant community in New Hampshire. And there are two additional organizations outside New Hampshire, but we are representing New Hampshire Indonesian Community Support and its members and who are affected by executive order, including one particular family who are asylum seeker couple and who is expecting a baby soon, but that baby will be affected by executive order, unless we stop the enforcement of the order, that baby would not be recognized as U.S. citizen.
So that baby would only be a citizen of Indonesia, like its parents, but not of the United States.
It's a little bit hypothetical, but it's unclear either, because they are asylum seeker, and according to the Indonesian the citizenship law, it's my understanding that there has to be a separate registration of newborn baby overseas in order to receive the Indonesian citizenship. But it's unclear whether that could even be achieved in light of this asylum seeker, the status of this particular family.
If you have questions about this particular executive order that President Donald Trump signed on Monday, effectively ending birthright citizenship for many children born in the United States, give us a call at 800-639-2211. You can also email us your thoughts or your questions to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. We just got an email from John, who writes, President Trump and those on the far right have been saying we welcome immigrants with open arms, but we want them to be legal. Still, there is no move to allow them to be legal. That would take a lot more judges. So instead, walls are constructed and other means to try to keep them from applying for citizenship. Sangyob, I'm curious what you think of our listener John here's thoughts about Trump's executive orders on immigration, that there's some rhetoric around, you know, we want immigrants to come here as long as they are legal, but there are at the same time a lot of barriers to coming to the United States legally. It's a bit of a catch-22.
It is. And first of all, I want to say that the executive order directly opposes our constitution, values, and history, putting aside the policy choice or the rationale, whether there is even rational reasoning behind the policy. And it create a permanent subclass of people born in the United States, but who are denied for rights. Now, in terms of the policy, it is a little bit ironic because of, for example, President Trump appears to be supporting H-1B, the temporary workers with specialized knowledge, but then their babies would not be recognized as U.S. citizens under this executive order because they are not permanent residents. So it's a little bit ironic that while supporting the legal immigration, it would actually restrict and further eliminate the legal immigration in the United States.
So you are seeking with this lawsuit a preliminary injunction. Can you explain to us exactly what that would do?
Sure. Lawsuit takes time. Mm-hmm. So after we initiate filing complaint, if there's a reason, which we have here, that the law should be enjoined, or we call it is stopped through the lawsuit, we often file this preliminary injunction so that the court basically temporarily stops the enforcement of the law while the court reviews and assesses the ultimate merits of the case. Because the order will go into effect 30 days after Monday, we don't have much time. And also, in particular, this will affect the one particular family member of the Indonesian community support who would lose the baby's right, his or her baby's rights, and would not be recognized as U.S. citizen. Because of this urgency, we are seeking plenary injunction so that the court can stop the enforcement of this executive order before the 30-day the timeline.
We're speaking with Sangyob Kim, a senior staff attorney for ACLU of New Hampshire. They've filed a lawsuit against President Trump and other government agencies over an executive order that effectively ends birthright citizenship here in the United States. I should also note that attorneys general from about 20 other states, including Vermont, have filed a separate lawsuit on Tuesday, and they are also seeking a preliminary injunction. And in a press release about it, Vermont Attorney General Charity Clark said, and I'm quoting here, "I swore an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America, and this executive order is plainly unconstitutional. Babies born here in Vermont have a constitutional right to be embraced as Vermonters and Americans." Sangyob, does what you are working on right now, this lawsuit, is there any overlap with this other lawsuit that attorneys general have filed? Have you taken a look at that? Why are there two efforts here, and probably more?
Yes. So there are multiple lawsuits nationwide. It's my understanding that there are at least two lawsuits in Massachusetts, including the Attorney General's lawsuit. There's another one in Washington State. And I think there's another one recently filed in Maryland as well. Now, while there are overlaps over the scope of the relief or the specific the target, the lawsuit is aiming for, which is the stopping the enforcement of the executive order. These lawsuits are being filed in different states, and it's unclear what's going to happen in terms of which case will to stop the enforcement of the order, at least for now.
And are there other issues or executive actions of President Trump's that your organization, the ACLU of New Hampshire, is preparing to either file a lawsuit on or combat in another way?
So ACLU and our affiliate in New Hampshire have been preparing for a very long time for the cruelty towards immigrants that the Trump administration could bring. So including this lawsuit, we've been preparing for other lawsuits, and we would seek the court's intervention when we encounter and see the victims of the cruel immigration policy.
And Sang-yeob, lastly, I'm sure you're in contact with a lot of people who are part of immigrant communities there in New Hampshire over the past couple of months and just in the last few days. What are those conversations like? What concerns are you hearing about from people?
There are various concerns, obviously, and understandably. And it's concern over everything. It's not only limited to undocumented immigrants, but to permanent residents and U.S. citizens, all kinds of concerns that they have. And obviously, we cannot address all the issues and legal claims, but within, at least since immigration is my area, within immigration, we are trying to be available for any assistance in New Hampshire.
Sang-yeob Kim is a senior staff attorney for ACLU New Hampshire. Sang-yeob, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we are going to look at how Trump's executive orders could affect refugees and asylum seekers. We also want to hear from you. What are your thoughts about President Trump's executive actions around immigration? When you read about them or heard him discuss them at his inauguration proceedings, were you happy, relieved, anxious, angry? Call in and tell us about it. 800-639-2211 is our number. We'll continue the conversation in just a minute. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. If you're just joining us, today we are looking at President Donald Trump's day one immigration policies, how they challenge pre-existing laws, and what they could mean for immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers in our region, as well as folks here who are worried about border security. We're joined now by Sonali Samarasinghe, who is the Field Office Director for the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, USCRI, the Vermont office. Sonali, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Michaela.
We're so glad to have you. And we are also joined in the studio with me by Brett Stokes, an assistant professor at Vermont Law and Graduate School. He's the director of their Center for Justice Reform Clinic, which provides pro bono immigration law services. Brett, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Listeners, if you are an immigrant to the U.S. and you have thoughts about Trump's day one actions, we would love to include your voice in this conversation. You can give us a call at 800-639-2211. Sonali, Brett, we just heard from our first guest that the ACLU of New Hampshire has been preparing for President Trump's first day in office for many months now. They kind of knew what to expect and what they were going to need to work on. Sonali, was it the same for you and your colleagues at USCRI? Have you been preparing for this moment for a while?
Well, we have been anticipating some kinds of executive orders, and so I wouldn't say it came as a surprise. However, When it comes to how it impacts us on the ground, it is hard to predict. What I can say is that as an organization, we will continue to advocate at all levels and actually continue to keep the lines of communication open, considering that while there is this suspension of admission of refugees in place, there is also an opportunity for the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, to review applicants on a case-by-case basis. And also there is a provision to revisit the suspension in 90 days.
And that is to revisit it and also look at it could change when the policy, quote-unquote, realigns with U.S. interests. Is that right?
That's right.
Well, Brett, tell me about how you and the folks over at the Center for Justice Reform Clinic have been preparing for the start of this new Trump administration.
Absolutely. So just like my colleagues, Sing Yob, have already said, you know, we've been preparing. We knew that some things were going to be on the table. And here, the executive orders that came were really not a surprise to us. Project 2025, which was circulating before and while Trump was on the campaign trail, really laid out kind of a blueprint for what he's done here with these first initial executive orders. At the Center for Justice Reform Clinic, I've been primarily focused on how this is going to affect Vermonters here, specifically non-citizen Vermonters, and how I can do my best to respond to their questions, comments, and concerns. So I've been doing my best to kind of, A, review what's been coming out as it's been coming out, do my best to communicate what's been coming out, as well as try to respond as quickly as I can to, you know, these changes.
Yeah. Lots of changes happening right now. And we have our phone lines open. If you have feelings about these executive actions on immigration, one way or the other, you can call in and share your thoughts and feelings today. We have Katya in Queechee calling in. Katya, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I am appalled and dismayed at what's going on. It is disgusting. I knew this was coming, but I also don't even know what the controversy is in a sense, because in terms of its citizenship, that's constitutional. And I don't know how he's getting away with this crazy executive order. That's one thing. The other thing is I've known undocumented immigrants and dreamers for years. They are good, outstanding people. This is so crazy for everyone concerned, and I am so concerned yet again for the children who are going to be terribly affected by this. It breaks my heart, and I am thoroughly disgusted. And if there's anything I can do to help, I want to.
Thank you, Katya, for sharing that. You referenced dreamers. That's a term, for folks who don't know, for children who were brought to the United States without documentation. We got an email from Monica in Richmond who echoed some of the sentiments of Katya. Monica wrote, "I don't understand why an executive order that is so clearly unconstitutional has to go into effect. Do federal agencies have to implement any executive order the president signs? Is the only way to prevent this through the courts?" Sonali with USCRI, curious what your thoughts are there. Could you help explain this to Monica and the rest of us?
Michaela, USCRI and our office, we provide wraparound services, including securing housing, case management, employment, transitional short-term cash assistance, English language learning, health services, interpretation and translation, and of course, legal services and other supports. So, and we coordinate closely with the State Refugee Office, our municipal partners, schools, healthcare providers, and a myriad of social service providers to ensure that refugees are given the tools and supports necessary to achieve self-sufficiency, which is the ultimate goal. So, in that sense, we will not stop our services in in any way, shape, or form, we will continue to serve our clients. For instance, who have been resettled here for several years, but more particularly, if I just were to give you a number, just in the last year and a half, we have settled over nearly 350 individuals, and they will continue to get our support with the ultimate goal, of course, of self-sufficiency through employment. So we have not in any way stopped or there has not been a halting to what we do as a refugee agency. I want to just remind that the refugee resettlement is a federal program. These refugees are subjected to the most rigorous screening measures. They're thoroughly vetted before coming to the United States. And most people, they have lived in refugee camps for over a decade. They have waited in line. They have followed the rules meticulously. And in some cases, it may take years before someone is referred to for resettlement. And you know, between the time they're referred for resettlement and then their ultimate arrival in the U.S. So it is a thoroughly vetted program. They are security cleared. And so it's a safe program in that sense. So I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah, thank you, Sonali. And I'm wondering if, Brett, you might be able to speak to our listeners there, the caller and the emailer, who are confused about why an executive order that does seem to violate the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the one around ending birthright citizenship, can still be put into effect.
Absolutely. So I'm going to start by saying I think a phrase we're going to find ourselves asking ourselves a lot over the next 4 years is, can they do that? And, you know, they're starting out the gate pretty quick. To respond to that, do you have to put in an executive order that's so clearly at odds with constitutional, you know, bedrock case analysis as well as the 14th Amendment? No, you don't. But the way that you have to fight that is through the courts. Mm-hmm. So just like Sanyab did and just like, you know, these 20 other states have done, you have to go through the process, unfortunately. If it's not challenged, it could, unfortunately, be, you know, put into effect without any sort of repercussions. But thankfully, we have people out there looking out for our non-citizens, looking out for our immigrant populations that can say, hey, this isn't right. This is unconstitutional. So that is kind of the process that has to be gone through in order to, you know, fight these executive orders, and something that I hope keeps happening.
Mm. Let's bring on Peter in Burlington. Peter, what are your thoughts or your question coming into this?
Hi, good morning, good afternoon. My name is Peter. I work as an emergency medical technician at UVM. I am a child of immigrants. I work with immigrants. I live with immigrants. I received birthright citizenship, so to see this attack is very upsetting, and I'm just absolutely livid. And I just appreciate hearing all these people who are working to fight back against this. Hmm.
Thank you, Peter. Have you spoken to your parents about this? I'm curious what their thoughts are compared to yours.
Yeah, they're upset as well. They were naturalized in 2008, so they do have their citizenship now, but they were given this opportunity to come to this country and to work here and live here, and seeing that just discouraged and discriminated against is just very upsetting for all of us.
Mm. Well, thank you, Peter, for calling in and for sharing your personal experience here. Brett, are you fielding a number of calls right now from folks who are equally concerned as Peter?
Absolutely, yeah. And primarily a lot of my calls are coming not just from my clients. So at the Center for Justice Reform Clinic, we do represent – we operate as a class at the law school, but we do represent just over 100 non-citizens here in Vermont. We should represent more. But we're receiving a lot of calls from our clients. We're receiving a lot of calls from folks that are just scared. And so we're doing our best to respond to those. And at this point, you know, getting the word out and having opportunities like this to be able to educate the community, I think, is about as good as we can do.
Mm. And Sonali, same question to you. Is your office receiving a number of calls, questions, concerns from the folks that you work with, refugees, asylum seekers, immigrants?
Yes, we are. And it's a lot of questions and you know, doubts, not knowing what's next, and we are trying to provide support. I think the most devastating impact of this suspension has been the halting of the reunification of families. We have hundreds of Afghans who are here, who are waiting for their spouses to come in, their kids to come in. We had we have the case of a young Somali gentleman whose mother was waiting 13 years to get here, and she had just completed her final interview with USCIS successfully, and now she would be prevented. So that's one of those devastating impacts of this. And yes, they are concerned. But we are trying to reassure them that we are doing everything possible, of course, within the confines of an executive order. And we will continue to support whoever is here. Now, under the order, as I think Brett can talk more about, is that I believe SIV, so the immigrant visas, special immigrant visas, are not halted. So... And those are given to Iraqis and Afghans who have worked with the government or who have worked shoulder to shoulder with our military. So that will not stop. Hmm. And right now we are projected in Vermont through our office to receive 30 SIV holders. So we are still expecting that to happen.
Hmm. And Brett, that's your understanding as well, that the special immigrant visa program will continue?
Correct. Yeah, that's not named in the order that just came out. So as far as I know, the SIV program will continue. Hmm. That being said, it doesn't provide the same benefits that, you know, being able to enter the country as a refugee would. So the ending of a program like this certainly is, you know, devastating to groups, and certainly a state like Vermont that's so welcoming to refugees.
Yeah. Let's go to Jeanette in Burlington. Jeanette, what is your question or your comment today?
Hi, I'm Jeanette. I am a daughter and granddaughter of immigrants. My question, I have two questions, and I'm sorry if it's already been answered.
That's all right.
The folks who have come in as refugees through the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program, will they be protected? And also the Ukrainians who came in through the temporary program, will they be protected under the program, under, you know, the other programs that they were already coming in through now that we have this executive order?
Mm. Well, thank you for bringing up those two questions. I'll have both of our guests respond here. Sonali, are you familiar with either the two groups that Jeanette just brought up there?
Yes. And so what we know and what we – there was a communication by the Department of State earlier this morning as well, and we know that whoever – is already here in the United States can continue to receive our services. So we believe that they would be safe because this if they continue to receive our services, then of course they are protected. Mm. So that's what we have so far from the Department of State.
Thank you. And Brett?
Yeah, that's my understanding as well. The good thing about, I mean, I hesitate to say it's a good thing, but what most of these executive orders are doing are proscriptive changes, so that it's not going to affect anybody, as far as I am aware, who's already here in the United States under these programs. That being said, Sonali already mentioned this is a process where these folks who are applying to enter the United States as refugees have gone through rigorous screenings. One of the most rigorous screening processes that occurs when you're trying to immigrate to the United States. And on top of that, it's a process that takes an incredibly long time. So if we're to take the executive order at face value, if you're not already in the United States, you're not going to have an opportunity to enter the United States after Monday. the 27th.
One question I have, Brett, coming out of our show yesterday, which was focused on U.S.-Canadian relations and how some of Trump's executive actions could affect the regional economy there. We were talking about tariffs, things like that. One thing that came out of that conversation was that about 80% of the illegal crossings of our border with Canada, folks coming south, are along the Swanton sector, which runs along Vermont and New Hampshire and parts of New York State. And there have been ongoing concerns in our region about border security. And on Monday, just a few days ago, a U.S. Border Patrol agent was shot and killed by a German national who's here on a visa following a traffic stop in Coventry. I don't want to draw any sorts of ties between a one-off event and these broader conversations that we're having, but I do wonder if the concerns about security along our northern border, if they are founded, in your opinion, and could any of these executive orders help tighten security around that border?
So that's a great question, and it's something that's come up a lot over the last several months in Vermont, especially as there's been reports of more encounters at the northern border. I will say, even though there is an uptick in encounters, the number of encounters that occur at the northern border versus the southern border, they just aren't comparable. It's apples and oranges. So it's tough for me to say if there's a real concern there. That being said, the vast majority, clearly, of the concern from the Trump administration is focused on our southern border. None of these executive orders are focused on getting more for example, there's not a state of emergency being declared on the northern border. It's being declared on the southern border. The transnational gangs are being designated as terrorist organizations in Mexico, not in Canada, so on and so forth. So I think the writing's on the wall that there are going to be things that the Trump administration is going to try to do to expand border enforcement throughout the United States and all border regions. But I think the focus right now is on the southern border.
Okay.
If that responds to your question.
Yes, that does. Thank you. Let's bring in Kathy in Montpelier. Kathy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. Yes, so I'm wanting to hear from the panelists. The question arose about, do people have to implement these? And the response was it goes through the court. And I'm thinking about people who in our daily work lives, you know, the president says to do something, the Vermont leader says to do something, somebody's boss says to do something, and someone's in a position and feels like it's against the Constitution. What kind of supports are out there for someone who wants to stand up and say, no, I'm not going to do that? And, you know, how can we all as citizens be as courageous as we can? And there's going to be a real tendency to not want to say anything because you'll become a target, or you'll then, you know, have attention drawn to any of us. So what kind of supports are there? I'm thinking, too, of Timothy Snyder's book on tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, where he's got like 20 things that everyday citizens can do. Recommend that book and love to hear what the panelists say. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. And I also note, related to what you just said, I brought this up at the beginning of the show, but the Justice Department just sent a memo directing federal prosecutors to investigate state or local officials who obstruct immigration law enforcement across the U.S. Sonali, what are your thoughts hearing Kathy's question? What are ways in which people who might want to support immigrants, refugees, asylum seekers in our region, how can they do that?
I think, Michaela, firstly, I want to thank Vermonters for their generosity of spirit. They have always been on the side of our refugees and immigrants and our new Americans, and I want to put that out there. Ways we can help are sort of with direct services, kind of, maybe as a family friend, helping us you know, supporting them as a family friend, or buying grocery gift cards, or English tutoring, that kind of thing, just directly going to them. I mean, and we can help with that, of course, because we already do that. We have a huge network work of volunteers, just being there for them and making them feel safe and wanted and welcomed. I myself am a refugee. I came here in 2009. I was fleeing my country. I was a journalist, and my my husband was a fellow journalist, and he was killed.
Yeah.
And I there were threats to my life, and I fled. And I lost family and home and country and a people, and I came here. And what I found, that though I had known great loss, what I found in the U.S. and especially in Vermont was the beautiful and serene and welcoming that it, that I know is within this great nation of ours, right? And that's why I continue, because of my own experiences, I refuse to believe that America has lost its soul and heart. And I believe that we can find that in those little things, in our humanity, you know, and just being there one-on-one for these people and just welcoming them.
Mm. Sonali, I'm so sorry for the death of your husband, and I really appreciate you sharing part of your own personal story with us today as part of this discussion. Brett Stokes, what are ways, per our listeners' question, that people in our region can support refugees, immigrants, asylum seekers?
Absolutely. Well, I really like this question, and it really resonates with me, especially as an educator, because so often I'm with my students as they help their clients through what I would describe as the worst days, or at least worst times of their lives. It's really easy to feel discouraged. And so supporting refugees and asylum seekers, as well as just trying to find a way to fight back when you're feeling hopeless like this, do what you can. That's one of the places that I start from. If that means donating your time, there's a number of organizations certainly that are going to be welcoming of that. One that comes to mind is Vermont Asylum Assistance Project here in Vermont. You can find them at vaapvt.org. You can donate money to groups like that in Vermont. There are a number of different groups. You can find most of them through that website as well that I just named, as well as the Center for Justice Reform Clinic's landing page on the Vermont Law and Graduate School webpage. Donating food to necessary food pantries and stuff like that around town. Sonali had a great point, but just checking in, as simple as just saying, hey, how are you? How is this news hitting you with your immigrant or non-citizen community members? It goes a long way. And so I think that there are ways for us to feel more empowered, even when we know that it's hard for us to fight back. But I think we can leave the listeners who are concerned about this knowing there are a number of organizations that are doing the work and maybe putting a voice to things that you're feeling. And by supporting them, groups like the ACLU, Vermont Asylum Assistance Project, Center for Justice Reform Clinic, you're extending not just your ability, but like the state's ability, the country's ability to be able to fight back against these actions that you don't agree with.
Brett Stokes is an assistant professor at Vermont Law and Graduate School and the director of their Center for Justice Reform Clinic. Brett, thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Sonali Samara Singha is the field office director for the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, their office in Vermont. Sonali, thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we are going to speak with a Ugandan asylum seeker who lives in our region. That's in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac.
If you're just joining us, we have been discussing President Donald Trump's immigration-related executive orders and how they might affect refugees and asylum seekers in our region. Joining us now is Stephen Tendo. He's a Ugandan asylum seeker based in Colchester. And during his time in Vermont, he's worked as a chaplain and nursing assistant at the University of Vermont Medical Center. And he also runs a social services organization called Eternal Life Organization International Ministries. Just last Friday, he received a letter ordering him to report to the Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, in St. Albans to meet with a deportation officer. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michaela.
So, Stephen, you had this meeting with ICE. Was it yesterday? How did it go?
The meeting was yesterday, but the timing was scary.
Yeah.
And the way they summoned me was also weird, if I should say. Normally, I've always been reporting once a year, and it's been by phone. I call them and I tell them what I'm doing, that there is nothing that has changed about the address and my safety here. So I had reported in last year in November, on November 14th. I sent an email and I called them. They told me everything is okay. And so on Friday, I received a mail from them, which was written on 14th November. The day I called them is the day they wrote the letter that came through. And so it shocked me because I received the letter on Friday and they needed me on Tuesday. If they had wanted me to prepare anything, they would have sent it earlier. So calling my lawyers, they never knew anything about it. And so that sent panic waves for me and for my lawyers. They had to file for a stay in just like hours, and I had to look for support to go with me because you can never trust ICE in any way.
And how did that meeting go? What came out of it?
So I had a lot of support from Vermonters, and I really, really appreciate Vermonters for the kindness and the warmth that they showed me yesterday. When they saw the overwhelming support that I went with, that must have changed something. They told me, oh, we are sorry, we did not mean to cause any harm or any havoc. We just wanted you to come and we reschedule your check-ins. So from checking in once a year to checking in twice a year, from checking in on phone to checking in person, it is still concerning.
Yeah.
But
did they say why they're making these changes?
They did not say, but it's self-explanatory.
Hmm.
Yeah. So checking in person means that at any check-in, they can do whatever they want. And most especially in this administration, it's so dangerous because ICE can act as... I've been a victim of mistreatment in both administrations. And yeah. So I know what happened to me in the first term of Trump and how the ICE deportation officers behaved and how they used to get people to be deported and the tricks that they use. So they would never tell you that they're going to deport you. But any time that you go there, they can just round you up and take you on the next flight before you even organize your lawyers to do anything. So yeah.
Yes, and before relocating to Vermont, you were seeking asylum in Texas, where ICE officers subjected you to medical neglect and mistreatment, and you are now suing the U.S. government for those actions. You're from Uganda originally. Could you tell us a little bit about why you moved to the U.S.?
Uganda had become a trap for me. I started the social organization in Uganda. And Uganda has had a long-standing history of leaders who do not care about their people. My parents were royals in the country, and they stood for the voices of the people. And they supported the president who is there right now. But it is believed and confirmed that the president who is there now, who is Yoweri Museveni Kaguta, was not a Ugandan. He was a refugee who came from Rwanda in 1950s, grew up in Uganda, was fed. And in 1979, went to war because he felt that the administration that was in power then did not do enough. So he fought a war of over 5 years, which brought him to power. Now, I come from a kingdom that makes the majority of the population in Uganda. This is Buganda Kingdom, and it is from this kingdom that the name of Uganda is derived. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most wealthiest, biggest in East, Central, and Sub-Saharan Africa. So my mother was a princess in this kingdom. Mm. And if you do not have the support of the kingdom, you cannot be a president, because if the population is 45 million people, mm-hmm. Buganda formed the majority of that. And so the kingdom supported him. Mm-hmm. They agreed on certain things to do for the country. When the man came to power, and my father also served, was a chief in the kingdom and served in his government, plus my mother. Mm-hmm. When he came to power, he realized that he could not fulfill the bargain that they made, mm-hmm. the deal that they made. He decided to eliminate whoever was part of the deal one by one. That's when...
Including my, your family?
Yeah, including my mother and father in 1998. And so I was a teenager. I was just becoming a teenager in 1998. They killed them, and I had learned a lot from my family. So when I became 17, around 16, 17, I started this social organization of supporting people who have lost their people who had lost their parents, because the war claimed a lot of lives, and Uganda remained one of the most youngest country in the world. Like, the people were very young. All the old people had been killed by the war. And so when I started the organization, we started supporting the orphans. We started supporting a lot about education, supporting the mothers and all that. And what brought the issues for me to include the program of educating and teaching and encouraging young people to register to vote, those ones who had made 18 years and above, and massive of them registered to vote, and he was not popular and thought so that...
From that work, you were forced to flee.
I got tortured, my fingers were cut off and shot in the legs, and the torture went on and on until it reached the level of killing my brother and my uncle, and I was the next in line, and I ran away.
Oh.
So when I came to the U.S., they were brave enough to contact the U.S. immigration and tell them that I was a terrorist. Mm. That was the basis of denial of my case, I guess. Mm. Yeah.
And now you are fighting to stay.
I am fighting to stay because the situation in Uganda has become even more worse. More people being killed every day, and more of the people who are associated with me are dying every single day, either by poison, shooting, name it. Mm. Yeah.
Stephen Tendo is an asylum seeker who is based in Colchester. Stephen, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you so much for having me on this show.
Unfortunately, that is all the time that we have for today. But just as I said yesterday, we are going to continue to look at the implications of President Donald Trump's new policies and executive orders on people in our region over the coming weeks and months. We would love to hear from you on what you want to hear about and learn about, and the people you would love us to focus on. Vermont Edition at vermontpublic.org is the place you can always write us with your thoughts, concerns, questions, and opinions. Today's show was directed by Aaliyah Papes. Our managing producer is John Ahrens, and our producers are Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro. Anna Berg is our intern, and our call screener was Rick Barrett. Our theme music is composed by Myra Flynn. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch up again soon.